Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. I have Steve Panteliakos. Steven is the founder of Modern Movement Solutions, and he's also an adjunct faculty for Bellevue College in Bellevue, Washington. Also works with Bridge Physical Therapy and Wellness as an athletic trainer. He has an undergraduate degree from Seattle Pacific as exercise science, and then he went on and got his master of science degree in athletic training from the University of Idaho. Steven came by way of Dr. Chad Starkey, who I'd interviewed several months back and had on the show. And Dr. Starkey said, you know, I think Steve would be a great person to have on the show to talk about athletic training and his view of where the profession is and where he thinks it may be going. So we're going to focus today on a few, I think, really great subjects, future of athletic training, and then the return on investment as it relates to athletic training and some other current things that I think would be important for us to talk about. So, Steve, welcome to the show. So, can you give the listeners a little bit more background about yourself outside of what I've already kind of outlined about you?
Yeah. And thank you for that wonderful intro. I'll be finishing up my doctorate, my DAT, this May, and I'll be getting my DPT starting in this coming fall.
Excellent. You just want to keep educating yourself, it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, pretty much. I just like, you know, it's not that I've always wanted to be dual certed, but to me, it's not about AT, PT, chiro, this and that. I think they all offer something beneficial. But in my capacity as an independent provider, I just thought, are there still things out there that can provide me more utility to the patients and clients I work with? Things that would actually expand my scope, give me more tools in the toolbox that I can actually apply. But yeah, I started in exercise science. Before that, I was an audio engineer. I had two pretty significant hip surgeries and I had a posterior traumatic shoulder dislocation. Did two of my surgery rehabs with a PT, and then the last one was with, she was an athletic trainer and a physical therapist. I said, well, what's athletic training? And then when I went into exercise science, which my goal was to go into physical therapy, I spent a lot of time in the athletic training clinic at our university and found out, you know, because at that time I'd worked at as an aide in a PT clinic, and I didn't realize, due to my own ignorance, where all the different settings that PTs could work in. I just assumed, hey, if I'm going to be a PT, I'm going to be in an outpatient clinic. And and I saw a lot of the PTs there working so many hours, documentation on the weekends. And I just thought, ooh, I don't know if this is really what I want to do. Whereas in the athletic training clinic, Jason, or the head AT at SPU, I was like, man, this is what I want to do. He gets to spend lots of one-on-one time with his patients, with the student athletes. I was seeing a lot of stuff that was kind of aligned more with my values and things that I wanted to do. And then it was all history from there. And then once I graduated, I had the choice of either staying on at, I was working at a chiropractic clinic, my last year clinical rotations, and I had the choice either stay in Chicago and work there, or one of my previous preceptors, he was working at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State with the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. And it was much less pay than what I'd negotiated for in Chicago. My initial offer at the Chicago clinic was pretty much exactly what the NATA executive summary said. This is the average salary for athletic trainers. And I negotiated which I think we'll get to a little bit later, a three-year salary increase, saying, actually, I want to start at this. Year two, I want to make this. And then year three, I want to make at least this. And this is based on my billable hours, how many patients I'm seeing per week, et cetera. But I decided the first 3 to 5 years of clinical practice, in my mind, my goal was I wanted to obviously make enough money to be able to survive and live and pay expenses, but I wanted to get as much exposure and learn as much as I could. And I thought, I've never worked with Tactical before. This might not be an opportunity that comes up ever again. Mm-hmm. My family's in Washington. So I thought I pulled the trigger and pretty much applied, and they accepted me. So, and then after that, I worked with the Army for about a year and a half. And that was not as a GS position. There's government service athletic trainers. And then there's, most of them are contract positions. I was a contractor. There was friction between me and the contract company about how much they're paying the athletic trainers, the structure of H2F and how it was being implemented. And it just wasn't really aligning with how I wanted to practice. So came to the point where I'd slowly been working with people on a one-on-one basis, more as strength and conditioning, because I hadn't formed my LLC. So I wasn't working in the capacity of an athletic trainer from a legal standpoint. Uh-huh. But it got to the point where between the 40 hours I was working at JBLM, it was also an hour to hour 20 commute both ways. So just my hours and driving was about 50 to 55 hours a week. And I just didn't have enough time to spend on my business. So I put in my, I didn't give them 2 weeks. I gave them, I think, like a month and a half, because I'm a nice guy. But
we don't see that much anymore. I get staffed. They're like, hey, I got an offer. I'm going to leave in a week and a half. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You have a 35 patient caseload. What are we going to do with those patients?
Right? Exactly.
They're scheduled for the next 6 weeks.
So I gave them as much, you know, advance notice as I felt was appropriate. And then I just dropped everything and, you know, and was just trying to figure out how to start a business. And that's, you know, I'm very lucky that my mom, you know, my dad started his own business in insurance, and then he passed away when I was about, so my mom from that point sold the business, but she was a CPA for years and then pretty much helped him run his business. So I was mm-hmm. very, very fortunate that she has a strong understanding of tax law, about insurance, about formulating a business, because I looked through, and this is not a dig at the NATA, because again, I think a lot of this comes down to my own ignorance and naivete, but I went on, I said, hey, how do you start a business as an AT? How do you start an independent practice? And I really couldn't find anything. I reached out to some folks within, you know, emerging settings within the NATA. I never heard back from anybody. So I spent about 3 months looking at the Washington State Practice Act and looking at, okay, like, how do I do this? Which that in itself is nebulous. You know, I said, because, you know, obviously we know generally across the board, you need to have physician, either a supervision or supervision. But in the Washington State, it said, well, you can have a directing or supervising, or they can be consulting or referring. I said, well, what does that mean? They didn't define it. And that can be a physician, an MD, a DO, a physical therapist, a chiropractor, a dentist, or a massage therapist. So I said, that doesn't make sense to me. We have more education and a more advanced skill set than massage therapists. But for me to practice as an independent AT, I need to have oversight from a massage therapist. So luckily at that time, I was working with Betsy, who's the PT who owns, she's one of the owners of Bridge Physical Therapy and Wellness. She was working, has been working with Pacific Northwest Ballet for quite a few years. And through a friend, a mutual friend, she said, hey, I'm looking for an athletic trainer. Specifically, he connected the two of us. And then from there, I've been working with her. And I said, hey, I'm going to write up this collaborative practice agreement that basically says, you're a physical therapist, here's your scope. I'm an athletic trainer, here's my scope, based on the Washington State RCW. And this document just says, as needed, can I consult and refer with you based on patients if I need to? Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a lot of, I know some ATs who operate independently who don't have that. And they just, when they hit 15 days of no progress, they refer. Or if they work with someone for more than 45 days, they consult. But again, talking with old mom, she said, you might as well err on the side of caution. So
yeah, and that's when you form the...
Yep. And it's a PLLC, which again, if someone asked me the difference between the two, I probably couldn't tell you, but I know she said that if you're an independent provider in healthcare, it's a little bit more protection to have a PLLC, but she also said it's probably not necessary. I said, well, why not? And that kind of took me to where I am.
It's interesting because our practice and our profession is, you know, being in the state of Massachusetts, I've grew up in Massachusetts. I went to school in Massachusetts. I live in Massachusetts. I didn't leave. Our state practice act is a lot different than Washington State. The Board of Allied Health doesn't see any, I guess, wrongdoing, if that's the right word, for our athletic training profession. If you decided to treat and be able to treat in a clinical setting, you can't. You can do whatever you like, except cash payment. You could try to bill for service. You're providing underneath the direct supervision of a doctor that's overseeing you if you're seeing athletes. And the only restriction is the Medicare guidelines they won't pay you, right? So, and everybody follows Medicare. So a lot of people don't bill for service. If I decided to open up my own practice, I could be a sole proprietor and bill for my service and cash bill. And there's no reason why I can't do that in the state. So there's some colleagues of mine, friends of mine, peers that had opened up their own LLCs as well. If they have contracts outside of their normal job, they actually pull that in as the LLC and they can use that towards their business. So when I formed mine, I did mine. I got a second master's in applied sports science analytics. So mine is, you know, sports science and healthcare consulting is my LLC. So I can do the healthcare side of it and also the sports science side of it. And then leadership development isn't the first master's I got. So we kind of umbrellaed everything under that. So if I'm working with somebody that wants to learn more about how to develop, you know, healthcare providers, we can do that. If we want to do sports science analytics for athletes, we can do that. And if we want to do plans of care for an athlete, we can do that. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that falls under it. So I guess you're trying to be as diverse as you can in the profession. We do it all from start to finish where, you know, PT gets, and I've worked in PT for, you know, 28 of the 28 years that I've been out of school. I had a dual role. So, you know, coming out of school, I ended up getting a, you know, a shot at working for a company where it was a sports physical therapy practice. So one of the athletic trainers, and he was a PTA that worked for them, said, hey, we're looking for someone to come work for us. We need an athletic trainer. We need this contract to be filled. You want to come work for us? I said, sure, why not? And I mean, the amount of money I made coming out of school was like, I could make more at Dunkin' Donuts right now, you know, when I started. And that's the difference 30 years ago. But that's where I ended up getting my opportunity to start working for them. And then a lot of good things came out of that. I worked for a local college that was close by. I worked there for a few years. The local high school that, well, the school that was closer to the main clinic was looking for an athletic trainer. I got a call out of the blue from that AD, and he brought me in as their athletic trainer, you know, 2 years after I graduated from Northeastern. And he didn't want to contract with the physical therapy practice. He wanted to just hire me directly as an employee for the town. And the clinic, then the two owners said, yeah, absolutely. Like, that's fine. We don't have to then, you know, but we want to keep you on as a staff AT. So they kept me in the clinic, which was good. And they used me as a physical therapy aide back at that time. And then, you know, fast forward a little bit, I went back. I was thinking about going back and get my PT degree. And I'm like, I can't. At that point, there wasn't a transitional program. I couldn't leave my job, which I was in for 10 years. I had about 10 years of tenure actually with that high school. And I'm like, if I leave, that's the stupidest thing I probably ever would do in my career. Because I have a tenure for one, and I have a retirement set up there, which would be like, that's 10 years wasted.
At schools, you get scaling, right? Because I've got a buddy who...
And that's the, we kind of talked pre-recording, like there are some positions in AT where they're like, hey, you're getting treated pretty well. You're into a retirement system. They treat you like a really good employee. They know what you're bringing to the table as an athletic trainer and the resources and the value, right? We'll talk a little bit about value. But at that point, my boss said, hey, you should go back and get your PTA degree. Like, you can do it and you can at least start have a caseload in the clinic. And this will be better for you moving forward. And little did I know, he was thinking at the time of looking to move the practice either to private equity or sell the practice. And he was trying to protect me. And he's really one of my biggest mentors. He was one of my first guests on the show. So yeah, so that's where I ended up going. And then I ended up getting, you know, I got a master's, went back and got my PTA degree at Kent State, which was a transitional program, which was amazing.
From AT to PTA?
Yep. They took most of our courses from AT. So we had to go there 6 or 7 times for our exams and for our clinical, for our lab stuff that we had to do. I love athletic training. I mean, I know a lot of people have their different views, and I wonder, we'll get into this a little bit. There was a couple articles I saw that you had, you know, reposted on your page, which I pulled up, which I thought were great. And one was on return on investment, and then, you know, why I stayed and why I left athletic training was another one.
Yeah.
So I think it's a lot of good stuff we can chat about. And, but again, I think there's a lot of things that, you know, that speaking to Chad about this too, it's, and a couple other people, it's just an interesting conversation, because we know that we always go back and say the NATA, but a lot of it is, it falls on us as the profession, where some of us just say, you know what, I'm good at what I'm doing. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything. And nothing gets pushed. And that's the problem. Long kind of opening conversation, but where do you think the future of AT is going? I mean, you've been in it for several years. You know, you're getting your DAT. You're going to go back and get your DPT. What do you think? What are you seeing? What are you, you know, talking to peers about? What are you kind of reading? Because this is a big conversation that we've been having on where the profession's kind of going.
I think, speaking from my own experience, and again, I think this is why it has to be a conversation equally between industry veterans like yourself and the new grads, because I think if you ask most new grads, and just based on the statistics, not just from NATA salary survey, but I looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and just looking at job postings that not all, but most D1 and most athletic positions, I don't think currently the future of AT as far as what's going to promote the most growth and empowerment and advancement of ATs is athletics. I think the future right now of AT as far as what's going to actually grow our profession and get us a better foothold in the allied healthcare profession is emergent settings like private practice, like occupational settings, like tactical, but also more ATs doing what you've done, or doing what, you know, I'm fumbling my way through. I don't think it's realistic for every AT to work for themselves. I was a product of right place, right time, having the connections, having opportunities, and then being able to say yes to those opportunities. I think for an AT just out of school without any professional network, just saying, I'm going to strike out on my own and start my own thing, you could do it. It would be very, very hard. I was lucky that there was a facility that I could rent a space out of. A lot of the guys there were referring clients and patients to me to build up my client base. The several PTs and other folks that I work with were sending me patients. Like, it was very fortunate. It was more so like, here's this more or less perfect set of circumstances. I just had to choose to do it. But I don't think athletics right now is the future of AT, because it just, like you were saying, where do we see places that compensate or recognize the value of athletic trainers? Obviously, like you're saying, I think if there's a job that maybe doesn't pay super well, but there is ample opportunity for growth, real professional and personal growth, that's different. But if it's a position where it's like you're going to go in, you're going to work your hours, and you're going to get a 4% raise every year, that to me is not really promoting growth. So I think industrial, I almost went industrial, and granted, I'd say I'm not an expert on OSHA and all that other stuff. But when the place that I applied to when I interviewed, I basically said, this is what I'm doing now, you know, working in private practice and working with the military. This is what I want to continue doing. And basically they said, you're not going to be able to do that with us. This is, you know, you're going to be teaching fitness classes. You're going to be working more from a health and wellness standpoint. It's going to be much less clinical work and more just kind of the health and wellness approach. And I said, will I make more? Absolutely. But it just didn't align with what I wanted to do. But still, industrial, I think, recognizes right now the value of athletic trainers. I think GS positions, a lot of the government positions do, which when we talk about ROI, because I know there's been some confusion on one of the posts I made about, hey, you can use the GS scale. And people are saying, well, that's not how it works if you're applying for a GS position. And I'm like, well, I'm not talking about applying for a GS position. I'm just saying, here's a metric that we can use to compare. I said, if this is what the government says, if it's good enough for the federal government, it's good enough for you applying for these places.
Right.
But yeah, I think, long story short, I think the future of athletic training profession is in those settings and areas: physician practice, outpatient settings, private practice, industrial, consulting, tactical, because the AT skill set, kind of like what you alluded to, is, you know, jack of all trades, but really ATs just get shit done.
Right, right.
You talk to any athletic trainer, it's like, I didn't have enough resources, I didn't have enough time, here's all the things I didn't have, and I made it happen anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 100%. I think there is, you know, I look back at this article that you had posted from, you know, another peer that you had reposted, and I actually reposted it too, because I felt like it was a really good read for people to kind of dig into ROI. It says here in one of the paragraphs, which I thought was good, it says, the discussion I've seen for many years on the state of the future of athletic training has been very frustrating, to say the least. However, necessity is a mother of invention. Among the array of skills that athletic trainers possess, problem solving and resourcefulness are among the top. If you're an AT, you know what I mean. So if we could figure out just how any sports medicine problem that comes our way, how have we not been able to figure out our pay and what we deserve for that pay? So, I mean, it's pretty interesting. And I think if you look at that paragraph and just kind of think about it for a minute, you know, like I said earlier, we do everything from the beginning of care, identifying the injury, being able to prioritize that injury, be able to put a, you know, what complexity it is, what do we have to do with it? Do we have to triage? Do we have to send off a referral? Can we keep it in-house? Do we have to refer it out? Then get them back on the field and then go through that whole plan of care. That's valuable. And I think it goes back to, there's another equation on how you actually end up calculating value. And there's a big problem with athletic training as compared to physical therapy, is that if you're not billing for service, you're not getting money back into the system that you can justify your salary. And that's the hard part. But I think if you look at it, we're a liability. If you think about it, there's a liability attached to it versus a profitability attached
to it.
We're
not an asset. We're a liability.
And that's the problem. So how do we change that is the question, right? So if somebody wants to dig more deep into that article, they'll see like there's some great examples there in that article. And if you guys look on one of my posts on LinkedIn, you'll see it. If you look at Steve's, you'll find it on his too. It gives a little bit more in-depth information. And there's a couple of things I'll actually allude to in a little bit. But
yeah, Ryan Lowry, he's the guy who posted it. Yeah, and I think he does a good job there, because it's trying to show, well, here's how much money we saved. Well, we've done that. The study that they did with the two embedded athletic trainers with the U.S. Air Force over, you know, I think it was over 2 years during 8 weeks of basic training with, you know, thousands of soldiers of U.S. Air Force trainees. And what they found is that they calculated, you know, based on, you know, they had like a 26% decrease in all cause, like, or musculoskeletal attrition, like 16% decrease in bone stress injury, all these things they did. And they calculated like, hey, if these things hadn't happened, how much money would the Air Force have spent on treatment? And they estimated it was somewhere between $10 and $11 million over those 2 years. And these were two ATs who were 6 months out of school. They had oversight from two faculty members and one sports med physician who was, I think, 2 years post-fellowship. So we've shown ATs how much money they can save, but we don't see that really translating outside of, you look at the GS positions, they're starting ATs at GS-11. And outside of that, and maybe industrial, we just don't see that translation. Whereas in a private practice, like a physician practice, I posted another article, and it's a study, it's older, but they basically showed, ooh, how much, what's the profitability of an athletic trainer in a physician practice? It's very high. Any AT can do it. When I worked at the chiropractic clinic, granted, insurance doesn't always reimburse 100%, but I assumed that with reimbursement being, let's say, 80%, averaged how many people did I see per week? The CPT codes that I was billing were Therex and Theractivity. Where I was located in Chicago, the reimbursement rate was the same. So I said, okay, I know I'm bringing in $44 per unit. That means every patient I'm seeing for an hour, it's $176. Boom. At the end of that, I can say, this is what I think I brought in. And I would like that. I'd like to see 25 to 33% of that as my salary. You compare that to what the NATA salary survey or even the BLS showed as the average or median AT salary was much higher than that. But that gives AT something to say, hey, this isn't me just picking a number of what I think I'm worth. This is what I know my value is based on an objective metric. Because for a business, if you're bringing in X amount of revenue, and you're asking for 100% of it, it's not sustainable. They can't give you that.
Yeah, yeah. And we go back to the conversation a lot about, you know, if you're taking and you're using the data appropriately to be able to justify what your worth is, then you have everything you need. So from day one coming into camp, where you have all the evaluations, all the treatments, all the documentation in order, and all the software now actually populates CPT code. So or at least most of them anyway. So you could, if you document appropriately, you could say at the end of the year, or the end of the quarter, however you want to look at it, these are the evaluations I did, this is how many treatments I did, and here it spits out the number. And you could say, like, this was what actually saved, you know, the university, the college, the whatever, if it was an industrial setting, this we're saving for money, why aren't we paying this out in salary? It kind of goes back to the conversation of, you know, are we more of a liability than an asset if there really isn't true money being transferred back and forth as a billable service. And in some states you can, but I want to say there's three states, maybe four states that you can bill as an AT and get reimbursement, which is kind of obscene. I don't understand why we can't If we're working under position, working in an athletic setting, we see probably in our clinic alone, we probably see 75% of the people come in are athletes because they're playing pickleball, tennis, golf. Those are athletes to me. And we say there's industrial athletes as people that are coming in for work conditioning. They're an industrial athlete and they should fit under that umbrella and there should be a billable service under an AT. So it is quite interesting to kind of see, but I also throw it back on us. I mean, I feel like if there's people that are happy with what they're making for a salary, they're not going to complain. And if there's not a big enough voice, like the NATA, I mean, that's one of the questions we're going to kind of go over, like what's the state of the NATA right now, where they just shook up the whole executive board, right? So I think trying to understand like where is the organization as a whole and what's their focus right now. I think I don't even know what the stat is. I want to say, I was just talking to someone a few weeks ago. I want to say like a quarter, if not more, of the athletic trainers in the country aren't even part of the NATA. Like they're not even members.
Yeah.
I don't know the specific stat, but it's pretty staggering. It's not even, you know, what it should be. And I think the same, it's probably the same for the APTA. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that don't belong because they don't agree with what they're doing. So
they're also bigger though. I mean, there's like tons of, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but there's what, about 60,000 ATs. And I think last time I checked, there's somewhere between like 250,000 physical PTs. Therapists. Yeah, something like that. But they've also been around longer. And we are a young profession. I get that. But yeah, as far as the NATA, because I think a lot of my posts, a lot of this just has to do with, like, you know, anytime you're posting on LinkedIn or social media, there's always a lot that gets lost in translation. And because I get a lot of messages from folks saying, like, well, you're saying that, like, it's not the NATA's fault. It's not the NATA's the bad guy. They're not there to save us. And I say, I absolutely agree. I want to state now that I don't think it's up to the NATA about like making this change for us. NATA, again, as 501c3 nonprofit, and again, I'm learning stuff through this too, because I was thinking, well, what could they do to help with the messaging? I thought, well, why don't we on the executive summary or even on the NATA salary survey just say, hey, this is what ATs are making in GS positions. This is what they're making in occupational. This is a ballpark of maybe what the professional value standard should be for an athletic trainer. They can't do that. They can't make a recommendation as a nonprofit. I didn't know that before. I know it now. I still think that, because I was talking with someone, they said, well, no company, no HR department uses the executive summary to set salaries because it's self-reported. It's not reliable. And I said, that might be true. Based on my experience, which again, I'm an N of one. I'm a sample of one. So this in the grand scheme might not mean anything. But the jobs where I was offered a salary, both times, the number they gave me was exactly what the average was on the executive summary.
Yeah, so they were going by what the executive summary is saying.
Going by, right. And that's what's the purpose of the executive summary? To educate and inform employers on athletic trainers and what to pay them, basically. Like that's by the NATA's own statement. So I think there are things that the NATA could do. And I'm sure there's a lot that the NATA is doing that I just don't have the time or the energy to know everything. I think that's maybe one point where the NATA could do more is actually just educating athletic trainers on what is the NATA actually doing? Like let us see behind the curtain. But things like their job board, I get it. That's a revenue source for the NATA. And as a business, you need the more revenue streams, the better. But I look at that and say, what does that job board offer that I can't get from Indeed or Glassdoor?
Right. Yeah.
Nothing.
And, you know, it's very interesting because I look at it. If I decided to leave my job, 30 years experience, right? Two master's degrees and 30 years of experience. If I look for a job in a setting similar to mine, I'd be making two-thirds less than what I'm making right now. And it is very interesting. Like, and I talked to AT retired. She actually was, I think, episode 13 or 14 with me. She's working for a group that she'd started, one of the co-founders called Athletes Better Together. I met her when she was an athletic trainer at Harvard University 31 years ago. She said she was making, say, $60,000, $65,000 a year then. Guess what the salary is there now for an assistant AT?
Same.
Same.
Yeah.
It's staggering to me. I mean, that's Harvard University, right?
Well, and who was it? It was, I think, Utah or Ohio. Yeah, it's like University of Cincinnati. And I try not to call so because I just, my goal is much people might disagree with. My goal is not to be a contrarian and just be like, conflict. But like I saw a job post from, I think it was Purdue. Now it's Fort Wayne, but I was like, doesn't matter. It's still Division I. And they offered like basically it was like $22 an hour. And I said, 2 minutes. I went on and said, jobs in Fort Wayne that require a GED. You could go work at a restaurant as an assistant manager and make $32 an hour. You could go work at this one and make 70. You could go to Bucky's and be a manager and make 120 grand a year. And then you look at University of Cincinnati, and they had this, there was this post saying, look at this, and it's beautiful. They have a whole new facility. They've got like this, all this fancy stuff just for the football team. And I said, I wonder what they pay their ATs. I don't know, but I'd assume that it's, you know, that money that goes into that. And especially with the NIL stuff, which I think student athletes should absolutely get compensated. If the university and other things are going to use their name, identity, and likeness to make money, the student athlete should see some of that. I've also read that the universities, to offset some of that cost, are then putting that into the cost on the students for tuition. I said, so you're willing to increase tuition to pay for this NIL stuff, but you weren't willing to do any of that previously to pay your ATs more. Just
and if you want to show you
what they value.
Yeah, if you want to look at something that'll make you sick, is look at what a strength coach makes in Division One, right? Or professional athletics. I mean, for that matter. I mean, I get it. They're improving performance for the athlete, which is making the school money. But what are we doing? We're keeping them healthy to keep the employee, which is the athlete, on the field to keep them making money, right? So it is very, very interesting. I think the priorities of the universities, the professional organizations, and whoever is hiring athletic trainers needs to kind of, you know, peel the onion back and kind of see what's out there. And I think it's what needs to happen, and people have heard me say this, and they can like it or not, we have to stop taking those jobs.
Yes.
In order for the salaries to increase, and the why. You have to give the data why. You can't just sit there and go in like, you know, because you can look at it both ways, AT, PT. You can't come out and think that you're worth $75,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year when you haven't done anything yet. And more importantly, you have to prove that, hey, I have bring value and I add value because of X, Y, and Z, and then back it up.
Yes.
And if you can't do that, then you're not gonna make the money you want to make, which kind of pushes a lot of us to go and do extra, right, and do other things and pick up per diem, and, you know. And I think it's a good friend of mine that I grew up with and went to Northeastern with. He's a PT, and he said, you know, he goes, you got to water your lawn, man, to grow your grass. He's like, you can't just step into a place and find out like, hey, here I am, you know, pay me 125 grand. He's like, that isn't gonna happen.
Yeah.
You know, and it is, it just, the amount of money we have to invest in education is absurd, first of all. But then the return on that investment, how long does it take for you to get that back? It's just like anything else you invest in. Like, if it's going to take you 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, is that worth it? Like, you alluded to, like, hey, you can get it, you have your GED and go make 100 grand being a manager at a restaurant. Like, it's, you know, how is that even possible?
And that's like the DAT, like where I get it now that it's master's. And I know some folks say the transition to master's was, you know, to some degree inflation, and to make it so that it's a higher entry point for ATs to try and, you know, supply and demand and all that. But at a minimum, we know, okay, you have to get a master's at this point. So that's not really an option. But things like for me, DAT, getting a DAT actually increase your scope? No. Is it actually a guarantee that you get paid more? No. But that's, you know, dependent on the needs of the person. For me, it was, am I going to learn things here that I don't know at this point? Or at a minimum, is it going to speed up that process? Epidemiology, learning data analytics, could I figure that out on my own? If I have a little bit of guidance and mentorship in the form of a DAT and how to do that, to me, is the cost of the DAT worth the 2, 3, 4 years it would save me to learn that stuff and be able to apply it effectively? To me, that was my purpose for it. But yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head where you look at any employer, any institution, if you want to see what they value, look where they put their money.
Right.
Athletics, they're going to pay like this, that Purdue job posting. They pay the head football coach $4 million. They pay the men's basketball coach $1.5 million. And the rest of the coaches' salaries are somewhere between 150,000 and I think 300, something like that. So you want to see what an institution values, look at where they pay it. When I was a contractor with the U.S. Army for H2F, I said, you know, you can look up and see, you know, what they bid on the contract. And it's always, you know, the lowest bidder wins. The Army's going to say, oh, well, this company is going to provide this service and so is this company. And this company says they can do it for less. We're going to take that contract. And so then I look at, you know, the average AT salary based on contract positions. They're not very good. And I said, well, I don't know what you guys are paying yourselves, and I'm sure the folks at the top are making a lot of money, but you look at where they spend it, and that's where they value it. And I think that is, you know, part of the discussion where it's like, you need to find a setting, or you need to look at a job and say, if you want to know if they value their AT, look at what they pay them. Mm-hmm. And the salary survey, right? I get it. Yes, numerically, AT salaries on average have gone up. But you compare that to even 2016, you compare the median salary to the one now, you adjust for inflation, it's gone down 5% mm-hmm. as far as the buying power. And granted, NATA salary survey self-reported, but I looked at it and I said, let me just look at folks in each setting who are just actually working as an AT. Like I don't have an EDD, I'm not working in education, not dual credentialed. And you start to see that average salary of, I think, 69,800, whatever they said the average is. I said, when do we start to see that manifest in those settings for folks who are actually just working as an AT? Mm-hmm. And it's either once you've been practicing for at least 11 to 14 years, or you're over the age of 35. And for the data on the young professionals who have only been working for 1 to 5 years, their median salary or average salary based on the salary survey was like 53K. And you compare that to 2016, and you account for inflation, your average salary of a young professional has decreased almost 25%.
Yeah.
So we see young professionals making less, and you see where can you make the most if you're working in higher education or you've been practicing for at least 11 years.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, I mean, I look at, you know, look at the GS scale as being like a jumping off point. Mm-hmm. But it's similar to the public school scale if you're a faculty yes. member. So very similar. You start off at a step, you move up. However much education you have, you move up. And you do at some point have a ceiling, but you get a percentage of increase every contract. So if you contract every 3 years, whatever that negotiation is, it's the COLA, whatever the COLA is, the cost of living, and then you have expenses, and then you have a longevity usually bump. And that's something, if you get into that position, it's great. They don't do that in the university. As far as I know, they don't do it in the university and college setting, right? I think there's a certain percentage probably contract to contract. And I know that friends that have worked or peers that have worked on professional level, their contracts rate from, I think they're pretty much like 3 year contracts. Some might go year to year, but usually they're 3 to 5 year contracts. And I have a few friends that work in professional baseball and football. So I know that they're, you know, it's a different animal. I mean, they get a base salary, which is usually very, very good. And then you're working off tips, which are even better. And then if you, you know, are fortunate enough to win a championship with whatever organization you're working with, then you could, you know, reap the benefits of a full share championship salary bump. So, but it comes with its, you know, positives and negatives, right? Not everybody wants to do that. Not everybody wants to be moving all over the place. I think, what do you think the profession can do for itself is the question. Like, what does the NATA, where do they kind of step in now where there's been a lot of noise around it for years, and there's been a lot of noise around being able to bill for service. There's been a lot of noise about, should we be called athlete training? Should we be called sports medicine? Like, what's yep. kind of, there's so much stuff out there. But if you could say, what do you think is the best way for the profession to improve its, I guess, ability to show that, you know, we are valuable in what we provide? More importantly, like, how does the NATA do that for us? I mean, we're paying this money, right? We're paying membership dues every year. Where does that go? Like, what does that do for us, right? And if you look at it, say there's 30,000 members in the NATA times $295, say 300 for a round number, right? Times 30,000, that's a lot of revenue year over year. Like, where does that go, and how does that help us as membership? Right.
I think that last time I looked, the NATA, like their total revenue, I think they make it's like 9 million off of, and most of it's from membership dues. And then the next biggest one is from conventions, like the NATA convention and stuff like that. And again, talking about the job board, like, yes, it's a revenue stream, but I think it's very minuscule when you look at everything. But I think the first thing is for us to be able to identify areas where we can make positive change, we have to know, like, where are they actually spending it? And even when they do the breakdown, I'm like, this doesn't give us enough information about where they're actually spending it. And for example, where I think they could spend it better, this is one small example. I've had the privilege to present at NAWADA, Northwest Athletic Trainers Association, the California Athletic Trainers Association, with one of my old faculty members. I'm going to be presenting at NAWADA again with a previous student of mine. And I had the opportunity to present at NATA in New Orleans last year. And I said, yes, that would be awesome. They weren't going to cover, like, I had to, when I looked at airfare, I was like, I can't afford this. It was going to cost me, like, even if I stayed at, I was like, Motel 1. I was like, I can't even afford Motel 6. Like, where's the Motel 0?
Right.
Plus everything else is going to cost me like $3,000. I said, I just started my own business. I can't afford this. But then you look at, you know, how much does it cost for them to host, you know, a 2-day at one of these conventions, like a thing that's just on dry needling, which I think, again, that's a whole other conversation about, you know, different modality. I've got no problem with dry needling, but I'm like, if we look at where we're spending the money, how much did it cost to bring folks in and instructors for 2 days worth of dry needling or this other thing, when really we could have, at a minimum, paid for the folks who are coming on their own time and their own schedule to try and further educate and inform our profession, but also maybe saying, hey, why don't we offer something that says literally 2 days, you come in, we say, based on whatever setting you're in, let's sit down and figure out how you can demonstrate your professional value and how you can communicate it. You can go learn how to dry needle whenever the hell you want. And first of all, can you dry needle in your state? Washington State, I can't even do it.
Yeah, you can't, depending on the state practice
act. Can't even do it. And so I'm like, first of all, so you do something like that where it's like you're alienating a certain percentage of your membership base just based on the fact of legality. I can't, why am I going to invest my time in this if I can't even realistically do it? Whereas what percentage of ATs could benefit from learning strategies to communicate and demonstrate their value? Every single one of them.
100%.
And I think at the programmatic level, I think, I don't know if this is a BOC or a Katie thing, you know, yes, obviously students, we need to know, you got to be able to pass your BOC. You got to know the basics, the fundamentals. And I'm a strong advocate that the first thing you should focus on mastering is the basics, is the fundamentals, patient communication, your exam process, all that stuff. But also sitting down with students and saying, look, like the conversation we're having today, if your value is tied not to what you can offer as a professional, but the setting you want to work in, I think if you want to work in the NFL, the NBA, whatever, good for you. But the difference between a dream and a desire is, like, you can have a dream to work in the NFL, but if you're going to go do it, or you're going to go work somewhere and you're going to accept $30,000 a year or some, you know, internship that's not even guaranteed for 2 years, and you're going to be making peanuts, you're shooting the rest of the profession in the foot. And that to me is a desire, not a dream, because we need to stop putting our individual desires above what's best for the profession. And as far as NATA, I think, I don't know where they're spending all their money. I don't know, but I think they need to focus on spending it in areas that I think are going to be more beneficial. I do think third-party reimbursement is paramount, and not even so that we can bill third-party. In Washington State, like we were talking about earlier, I've generated super bills for some patients. They get denied because they say, well, you're not performing their services within a PT clinic. But even if I could, for me as an independent provider, if we gain direct access or third-party billing, A, because I'm cash-based, that would actually increase my ability to work with more people, because I could say, hey, now at least this might get accepted. You might get 30% of it back, but that's saving the patient. But also in the grand scheme, when we look at allied healthcare professions, they say, hey, chiropractors have direct access, massage therapists have direct access, physical therapists have direct access. Hey, athletic trainers also have direct access. That also opens up the market for competition. So now if you're looking at your neighbor, you're like, oh, I've got an issue. Well, there's a physical therapist. I could walk in there and they take my insurance. There's a chiropractor walking there. Oh, and here's this guy. He's an athletic trainer, but he's cash only. I can't afford that. Even though long-term, I have had some clients where, because my rate is $150 an hour for one hour session. It's $200 for an hour and a half when I do an evaluation, because usually it takes me an hour and a half to get through everything, especially if it's concussion. But normally what I tell folks is that, look, if I see you once for an hour, most folks I see at most once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks. My goal is to get them back to doing the things they want to do. So when we compare $20, $30, $40 copay 3 days a week for 6 weeks versus you see me once a week, maybe once every other week for 6 weeks, the cost is usually equitable. Or if anything, the cost is the same. But what the data shows is that you tend to get back, you tend to reach the outcome you want about 2 weeks earlier for about the same cost. And also then I'm not working for your insurance company. I'm just going to say, here's my skill set. Here's everything I have on the table. And in that hour I'm with you, I can use whatever I want. I'm going to use my expertise. We're not going to go by what some algorithm at, you know, some insurance company says we should or should not do.
Right, right. And what they're going to reimburse for.
Yeah, I'm working for you, not the company. So NATA, what can they do? For all I know, they're doing everything they can. I think it was President Deringer, there was some, I think it was like a virtual thing, and or she was talking to actually my class virtually, and she said, the best thing you can do is stop taking low-paying jobs. I think that's the best thing that we can do and that the NATA can do is pushing that message. But it comes down to the AT, the individual. If you're not willing, if you're willing to take low pay, either because, well, I love my athletes and I'm, okay, got it. Or, well, I don't care how much I get paid because this is the setting I want to work in. Or, well, I can work this low paying job because either my partner, significant other, or I have a trust fund, whatever the reason. Whatever those reasons are, none of them are a good one. Because if you're not going to get paid the right amount, if you're not going to get paid what your value is, then either you need to find a job that will, or you need to leave and change professions.
Yeah. I think one of the things that was given to me years ago, it was one of my clinical instructors back in the day. And he actually, him and I sit on the Board of Allied Health for the state of Massachusetts. He said to me, he goes, apply and get your MPI number, like right off the bat, like get it, like have your MPI number. That's something that you can use for the rest of your life. You could attach it to, if someone was paying out of pocket to get reimbursed, you could attach to that and they show you're a provider. You can then give that to the patient on a super bill or however you wanted to put it together. And then they would actually get reimbursed. And I've had to do that a couple of times with people out of the country that had come in and couldn't go to PT and wanted service. And they knew me. I got a doctor referred them over and said, hey, you know, what do you want to do outside of my normal practice? I had seen them. And I said, this is what it is an hour. And they submitted it over the time that they were here. Their insurance company reimbursed them 100%. Like, it wasn't like, they weren't going to get reimbursed. It was that they said, oh, that's fine. Do they have an MPI number? I'm like, yes, here's their MPI number. Doctor referred them over. I was under the umbrella of the physician treating them. Yes. And that was how it worked. So there's definitely a way to do it. I think it wasn't, you know, a legal practice. It was 100%, you know, what the Practice Act states and what you can do. And I think it's an important thing to tell young professionals is like, get your MPI number, set yourself up to be able to do what you can do under your, what you feel you're comfortable to do and learn and get better and gain the expertise and have your niche for whatever that may be. If it's secondary school setting, college, university, professional level, traditional, if it's, you know, private practice, industrial, however you look at it, municipality. I mean, there's athletic trainers in every part of, I mean, we're in NASCAR, we work for Disney World, we work for Universal Studios. I mean, you figure.
PBR bull riding. It's
yeah, I mean, there's everything, right? You can work for NASA. I mean, there's athletes everywhere. In the military, if you're a veteran or work for the military, you can work, like you said, government settings. So I think there's definitely the ability to open the door for more opportunity, but it's understanding, like you had said, and I hope the NATA does this, and if they're not doing it, they should be doing it. If you're listening, NATA, put the message out there. It should be a, you know, a newsletter that goes out, stop taking low paying jobs. Like, that's what we should be doing and advocating for your members, because you're taking a lot of our money. And, you know, to go back to your conversation about, our, you know, getting asked to present. I mean, I go back to, I got asked to present at the NFL Players Association conference in Boston on concussion. This is going back, I don't know, 15 years ago. They pay for everything. You know, they pay for you to get there. They'll pay for a hotel if you're out of town. They give you a stipend. I made in 7 minutes more than some people make in a week to go up and talk. Mm-hmm. And it was, when I was going up just to do a favor for one of our physicians. And I ended up dual presenting with the head athletic trainer for the Vikings. And we both had 7.5 minutes to talk. And then when I got finished, I was talking to one of our physicians. I opened the envelope and I looked at it. I was like, what is this?
He
goes, no, this is the stipend for every speaker. And I'm like, holy crap, like I should just do this for a living. And it was literally for the 8 minutes and probably hour and a half I had to prepare. I mean, it was more than some people make in a week, which when you're dealing with that type of entity or a big physician group, they pay for everything. And if the NATA is pulling in $9 million a year, you know, there should be some wiggle room to be able to pay its presenters, to be able to bring in quality presentations and to make people feel good about what they're doing for the profession, right?
And I think ROI, I do like I said, the GS scale, because that to me, for young professionals, I think the best thing they can do now is, there was someone on LinkedIn who same thing. She said, hey, I'm an athletic trainer. I've got my bachelor's. I'm in North Carolina. I've got 8 years experience. How can I use this? And I just said, hey, here's what you do. your 8 years experience, you go to the locality table. So you find the table for North Carolina. It's got the grades and the steps. And I said, steps from step one to two, two to three, three to four equates to 1 year. And then I think four to five, five to six, six to seven is two. I said, based on your 8 years experience, you'd be at step six. Mm-hmm. Bachelor's degree, the GS skill, they normally say you're at a seven. But I said, it's way easier than that. Just look at what the government's already paying athletic trainers. They're almost all GS-11. Air Force might even go up to 12 or 13. So I said, go to GS-11 for North Carolina, go to step six. And for her, it was about 90,000. Now, just for everyone out there who's an AT, if you think if you were an AT, regardless of what degree you have, but let's say you have 8 years experience, would it make sense that an athletic trainer and the expertise and knowledge you'd have after 8 years of quality experience, would it be reasonable for that person to get paid 90K? In North Carolina, 100%. In Seattle, Washington, and again, they're all based on the area. So the Seattle, Washington scale, it's got a locality payment increase of almost 32%. To live comfortably in Seattle as just a single individual, me, you'd need about 86,000, 85,000. When I go to GS-11, I've got 3 years experience, boom, 88,000.
Yeah, so it's right in the wheelhouse.
Right in the wheelhouse. So if you don't know, like, I think the GS scale is a good way to determine. Now, if you were a brand new grad, GS-11, I'd be 83. Might be hard, but if, let's say, like that place in Chicago I was talking about, if you say, hey, we'll start you at 65, but year two, you're going to be making this, year three, you're going to be making this. I'm like, hey, if in your first 3 to 5 years, you can get up to a comfortable cost of living and you're getting mentorship, you're getting career advancement, I think mentorship is huge. I wouldn't be where I'm at, either in my clinical practice or where I'm at professionally with my business without mentorship. So where can we spend money? Where can the NETA or just programs as a whole think educating students, giving them the tools and the resources to be able to demonstrate and communicate their value, and also mentorship, mentorship, mentorship. I think students should be educated on how to do what you've done and what I'm trying to do, even if they don't do it, just saying as an option. We had to get an MPI number in my master's program. Mm-hmm. I thought all students had to do that. But I think things that we can do to set up the future generation for success is teaching them when to say no and when to say yes. Say no to low-paying jobs. Say yes to mentorship. Say no to things that I would consider not low-value care, but things that don't add a lot of utility, like spending thousands of dollars on this Con Ed course that you may not be able to even apply in your practice. Say yes to things that are going to teach you how to be a better communicator, how to understand business, how to understand how to demonstrate your value.
Yeah. No, I agree. I never negatively talk about education. I feel like education is always well spent, depending on, again, we talk about what your investment is over time, and your career should be 30 years, right? If not some longer, right? Depending on what you're doing. So if you break it down year over year, the investment's a good investment, right? To say the least. So I think it's how you use that investment to be better at what you do and what your craft is. And I think mentorship is a huge part of it. I still have many mentors that I go to and I call and I bounce things off of, and, you know, people within the clinic that I work with, and even some of the younger therapists that I have conversations with, they may be better at something that I am not good at. So we're going to work with each other to get better. And even athlete trainers that are in my league, we have conversations and talk about things all the time. But I think the communication piece is huge. Like, ask the questions. That's number one. Like, if you don't know, ask, because not everybody knows. I don't know everything. You don't know everything. Our physicians don't know everything. Our mentors don't know everything. And I think that's the best way to be able to improve and get better. And it's going to make the profession better. And that's the sustainability of the profession. Like, if you can do all the things we talked about in this conversation today, that's how the profession survives, right? Don't take the jobs that don't pay enough. Make sure that you understand how you can negotiate your price and your worth. And then get the experience. Don't be frustrated with, hey, I've been out for 2 or 3 years and I don't think I'm making what I should be making. Well, get better at what you're doing. Like, go out and spend extra time. And I don't want people just to go do something for nothing. But sometimes you have to do a little extra to show that, hey, you are part of this community and you're rooting yourself in the community if you want to stay in that community. And I think that's important no matter what profession you're working in. So for me, I feel like that's the best way to get the profession moving in the right direction. And obviously, we need the profession itself to be behind us as members, right? So I think that's key. That being said, do you think, I mean, you're going to be part of this. You're going to be a dual degreed, you know, professional at some point, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's the answer, or is that just specific to the person, right? And it's kind of a, I think, an interesting question, but I think if you think about it, I know plenty of people that have gone through that, but I don't know if they use it in the right way for it to be profitable for them, right? If you're going to work in that type of setting, does it help you or does it just other letters at the end of your name, I guess, is the question.
I think I'm going to use the answer that I heard a lot in undergrad is it depends because of the reasons you stated. I think across the board, I don't think it's a blanket solution. I think it does come down to the individual. I think dual credentialing, I think in certain situations, like I've heard talks that I think the NBA Players Association, the players prefer that folks on the sports med team, right, as opposed to someone who's just an AT or just a PT, I think there's been talks that they prefer someone who is dual credentialed. And it's not about they like athletic trainers or physical therapists better. I think it's more from a standpoint of they want someone who has that broader skill set. Mm-hmm. But when you look at cost, you look at the cost of, you know, to get your bachelor's and then your master's for athletic training and then the DPT, I think cost benefit for most providers, for most clinicians would not be worth it. I think for me personally, it's the right decision because for what I want to do, it maximizes my skill set. Now, if I was only making 50K, there's no way. A, I couldn't afford it. And B, and this last year, I mean, that's about what I made, but I was only able to work about 20, 25 hours a week with my individual patients. But my plan is to that get up to 40 hours and that's okay. Like I recognize it's going to take time. So I'm literally, when we were saying, it's okay to take a job that maybe doesn't pay you exactly what you're worth when you know that there's room for growth and opportunity. I mean, starting your own business, that's literally the definition. The fact that I was profitable at all, my mom said, was a miracle. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, I did all right. She's like, you're doing great. Like, you're actually in the green.
Yeah.
So I think it's down to the individual. I think it can only be beneficial. The more ATs we have who are dual credentialed, I think it is helpful, but it depends on how we frame it. It's not from the standpoint of it's because you're now also a physical therapist that now your athletic training thing is worth more. Right. It's not that. Yeah. It's just you're more qualified. And I did have a colleague of mine say to me, which I think is a valid point, he was like, I respect you more because you were an AT and you got the experience as an AT and now you're dual credentialing, whereas the folks who go through the dual credential programs where you graduate with both. He said most of them don't spend the time in the trenches as an AT experiencing exactly mm-hmm. what it feels like mm-hmm. to maybe not be as respected by other professions. I think there's credence to that, but I think that's a case-by-case basis. I think whether or not you dual credential or whether you're just you have your AT credential, I think that's a drop in the bucket compared to everything else that you can do that we've already discussed.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have to agree. I think you know, the only reason I went back and ended up getting another master's in the applied sports science analytics, I'm forward thinking to when I step away from athletic training. If I retire from athletic training, like, what do I do? I'm not just going to sit on my butt for the rest of my life. Like, I'm trying to build something now for 8 or 10 years down the road that I can say, hey, now I have this that I can go to and I can help athletes and I can help people that are functional, trying to get back to their normal function. How do we do that? How do we work on sleep disturbances? How do we work on performance enhancements? Like, how can we do that and make it better? And I can use that now with the athletes I work with to try to help them improve and sustain what they need to get better in their injury recovery. So for me, it made sense to me, right? And it was something else that I wanted to do. And if I decided to step into something that was in a different position that, hey, you know what, Andrew has a master's degree in applied sports science analytics, and that's what we're looking for, is to have somebody that has that other education piece. So for me, that made sense, right? So it's different for everybody, like you said, but
it gives you utility though in what you want to do.
Right, right.
Like 100%. Even for me right now, the ballet company I've been working with, I've been working hand in hand with the physical therapist, and we've mm-hmm. been coming up with protocols and recommendations for concussion management, and we're hoping to do a study. Now, I don't need any further education to do that, but that could be a role for ATs on the consulting standpoint, where
the
you're just working with organizations.
You're throwing a dart at the dartboard with every single patient, right? Everybody's different. It's trying to work with that, you know, population. And it's a lot of people are afraid of that, right? They're afraid of the concussion.
Yeah.
I find
but
it
once
fascinating.
You understand it. Yeah. And I thought when we graduate, I do think ATs compared to other professions, we tend to have more expertise in concussion. It's just, I think it's just a part of our wheelhouse. Doesn't mean that PTs, chiropractors and other folks can't be just as knowledgeable, but it tends to be something that we focus more on. But even that being said, when I graduated, I thought, yeah, I know a lot about concussion. Mm-hmm. I took a course called Concussion Nerds from Natasha Wilch in Canada. And then I think Complete Concussion Management is another good course that I'm taking. And I realized, holy shit, I don't know anything about concussions.
Right, right, right.
But yeah. Not from a scary standpoint. I think as a young professional, it's intimidating at first when you're like, there's so much out there. There's so many other skill sets that I don't have. And it can lead to you almost like kind of recoiling back into your shell. But once you realize that that's actually like, there's so much more that I could do to add to your skill set and what you can offer from a value standpoint that people will pay you for fairly, I think that can be empowering.
Yeah.
It's like, don't be afraid of your own stupidity as long as it's conscious incompetence, right? You got to know what you don't know.
Right, exactly. You have to be afraid to be wrong or incorrect and learn how to get better at what you're doing.
Yeah.
To close out today, I thought today we had a pretty good conversation here. We probably can go on for hours. It was like talking to Chad. Chad and I were like, just started talking about
it. I know.
It was kind of funny, but what's a fun fact about you? What do you like to do outside of when you nerd out? I always say nerding out because a lot of us are just like professional education, like junkies.
Yes.
But what's kind of your fun fact about yourself?
Well, I've been on a big tear recently because half the clients I work with, I wear multiple hats. I'm not a CSCS and all that, but I do. That's the other thing. We do strength and conditioning. You
right.
don't need a CSCS
exactly.
to do strength and conditioning. If a job requires you to have it, I would still even talk to them and be like, hey, if you'll pay for it. I said, I've got a bachelor's in exercise science, a master's in athletic training, but you want me to get this other thing to do strength and conditioning. I would only do it if a place paid for it.
Right.
But half the clients I work with, we almost entirely do strength and conditioning. Some folks come to me for injury management. It's always at the end stage. So I've recently been reading a lot from Charlie Francis, Yuri Verkhoshansky, James Smith. I got like 5 books, which, and again, business expense. I said, this is for my business.
Right, 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 right.
So I've been reading into that because a lot of the athletes I work with right now, I've got a young man, he's a youth lacrosse player. It's, you know, I was like, I wish I knew more about how to specifically work on acceleration, right? Or top end speed, stuff like that. So I've been digging a lot deeper into things like that. And then also, you know, going from working with the military to the ballet, when I first started working with the military, I said, I don't know half the words they're using. I don't know enough about this environment. Same thing with ballet. I've been with them about almost 2 years now. When I first showed up, they said, you know, when I'm in fifth position or closed open fifth, and then I got to do an arabesque, I said, you have to show me. I don't know anything that you just said. So what did I do? Because I'm a contractor with the ballet, I get free ballet classes.
Mm-hmm. So you took ballet.
I took Foundations 1. There's Foundations 1 and 2, and then Beginners, and then Intermediate. So I've taken the Foundations 1 class 2 times now. I'm taking Foundations 2. And what I found is that it's, A, made me better at what I do, because mm-hmm. I now understand to some degree, I can communicate better with the dancers. I think it does give me more rapport with them. Like mm-hmm. I didn't do it just say like, look, I care. But they're actually happy. Like they're like, wow, like we're impressed that you're willing to do this.
Yeah, you understand their language, which is good.
Yeah, and to some very small degree, I can understand the physicality that goes into it. And let me tell you, anyone who doesn't think ballet dancers are professional athletes, go take a ballet class.
Yeah, good luck. You won't get through half of it.
No, I was wrecked. I was wrecked. And I do a lot of sprinting and stuff. So that's been my main thing. I've been reading a lot more about kind of more niche areas of performance training. And then I've been on a ballet tear and I love it.
That's good.
Super fun.
I don't think anybody wants to see me in a tutu or a...
Hey, I got mine. You can get I got a rainbow striped one on Amazon for $12. So
that's great. Well, Steve, listen, I appreciate you coming on. I think there's a lot of great content today that we're talking about. Hopefully it helps our profession and hopefully we get a lot of people listening. As always, it'd be great if you can help get this out there when we air it. And then hopefully we can keep this conversation going.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity and privilege.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.